And now on WRS, Michael McKay with the McKay Interview.
Hello, everyone. Virtual meetings do have their blessings, even though I might sometimes sound like an unenthusiastic supporter. Today's McKay interview is a good example because my guest is somewhere in Geneva, I think. But I wanted you to meet him and to hear what he has to say sooner rather than later about a number of topical issues connected to trade, to shipping, commodities, sustainability, and Africa. Michael Hacking is a friend of mine and founder and president of Moco, a company which describes itself as, and I quote from its website, a trusted global supplier of oil, reliable, responsible, and efficient, making a positive contribution to the communities we serve. He's on the end of a Zoom line, and I'm delighted to welcome him to the show today. Hello, Michael. It's good to see you, and thanks for making time for me and our listeners to the McKay Interview, wherever you are.
It's great to be here, Michael. Thank you very much for inviting me in. I'm looking forward to the questions that you're going to ask.
It's my real pleasure. Now, Michael, as we talk, our listeners will learn more about you, your company and business sector. But before we start, I ought to mention, for the benefit of those listening who do not live in the Geneva area, that this city trades, at least the last time I checked, about 35% of the world's oil, as well as a significant percentage of natural gas and ethanol. That is a remarkably high percentage for such a small city. And maybe you could explain during our conversation how that has come to pass. But I want to begin with an incident that dominated our TV screens for about a week recently and has since passed. The Ever Given, a container ship of gigantic proportions, blocked what is arguably the world's most important shipping lane, the Suez Canal, for 6 days. Now, listeners, just to give you some sense of comparative proportions, the Ever Given has a gross tonnage of 200,000 tons. The modern Queen Elizabeth has a gross tonnage of 91,000 tons, less than half the size. And those of us who grew up in the days of black and white television will remember that the famous Cunard HMS Queen Elizabeth, during the heyday of transatlantic luxury crossings, had a gross tonnage of 83,000 tons only. 12% of global trade passes through the Suez Canal, 50 vessels per day. Michael, I have a few quick-fire questions for you, and here they are. How much bigger can these container ships get? How has it come to pass that this is so critical to world trade, and it relies on this one route? Why not cut another canal? Compare the cost and the time of Suez versus Cape of Good Hope routes and what that means for the cost of goods, especially in your business sector. How much have prices risen since the blockage and have they fallen back down again? And is there a backstory? Is there another story behind the story we saw on our TV screens? Sorry for the flurry of questions, Michael, but over to you.
My goodness, that is a flurry of questions indeed. Thank you. Whilst COVID has created a complete havoc with international trade and globalization, the world is interlinked through trade and will be seeking even more efficient and cheaper ways of moving goods from surplus areas to deficit areas. Vessels are going to get larger, and indeed there are plans to build container vessels that will carry 24,000 containers, 20-foot containers. The MT Ever Given is one of the longest container ships of 400 meters, as you mentioned, with a container capacity of 20,000 20-foot containers.
So just say that again. It's going to go from 20,000 up to what?
24,000.
Yeah.
If you laid out all these 20-foot containers side by side, it would stretch for 90 miles.
Good. It's God.
A very huge number of containers. But perhaps a little history on the Suez Canal. The canal opened officially on the 17th of November, 1869. In 1967, there was a six-day war which closed the canal for 8 years. During this time, 15 vessels were trapped inside the canal and were unable to leave for 8 years.
8 years? I'd forgotten that. I was a young boy, but I'd forgotten that.
Yeah, so the Ever Given... should consider itself lucky if it gets out in a shorter period of time.
Well, I hope the Japanese owners are listening, Michael.
In 2014, it was expanded and widened at a cost of $9 billion, and the new Suez Canal was opened in 2015. The expansion increased the number of vessels able to pass through the canal from 49 to 97 ships per day. a total of the world's, well, 15% of the world's traffic goes through the canal. And this is approximately $9 billion of goods a day goes through, or 4 million tons of cargo goes through.
Daily?
Daily.
Gosh.
And on the 23rd, of course, the Ever Given was the fifth in the convoy of 15 vessels passing through the canal, going to Rotterdam from Tanjung, that's in China. It was hit by a strong and sudden wind. It seemingly lost its ability to steer, causing the hull to deviate from the waterway and hit the bottom. It ended with its bow wedged on one bank and the stern touching the other.
And with your long experience, Michael, that's quite conceivable that a strong gust of wind can do that to a vessel of that size?
Well, indeed. It's not clear whether this was an act of nature or of human error.
And that's being investigated now, is it?
That will be investigated. Yeah. 6 days after the 23rd, that's on the 29th of March, after dredging and assisted by a spring tide, luckily, the ship was partially freed. The bow was released later the same day, and after checking for canal damage, the Suez was reopened to shipping. In spite of this accident and closure of the canal, the waterway has always and remains today a crucial shipping route for oil and global trade. It's the most direct route to delivery of oil from massive fields in the Persian Gulf to Europe. Going through the Suez saves something like 11 days at 20 knots.
11 days
at
20 knots.
With an extra cost of approximately $1.5 million if you're to go around the Cape, if your destination is the Med or Northwest Europe.
So that figure of $1 million, that's per?
Vessel.
Per vessel.
Going around. So if you choose to go around the Cape, or you have to go around the Cape, it'll take you 11 days extra sailing at 20 knots, and it'll cost you somewhere in the region of $1.5 million to go around the Cape. But the operators have a significant advantage because they charge fees for going through the Cape, through the Suez. And they can just charge fees which are just a little bit less than it would cost a vessel to go around the Cape. So they can always remain competitive. In short, the canal is here to stay.
So I guess implicit in your answer is that there's no real interest on the part of the sovereign state there, I guess that's Egypt, to cut another route.
No, there was a pipeline that was cut some time back. This is when Israel and Iran were friendly. There was a pipeline that was cut, but this is not sufficient to create another canal to take the size of vessels that we're referring to. The consequences of this accident are considerable and very costly. And here's some of my...
Just give me a sense of that. Prices and the blockage, and if there's a hidden story that the ordinary punter watching on television isn't aware of.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, here are some of my views on what the of the damage that the accident has created. Already, the Japanese vessel owners have received a claim of $916 million from the Suez Canal authorities. The insurance market is absolutely in the doldrums at the present time. Reinsurance markets will have claims from the P&I Club. The salvage costs will be picked up by the hull and machinery insurance groups. And all these insurance companies will receive huge claims from different parties. And in one article in the Financial Times recently, it suggested the claims could be up to hundreds of millions of dollars. Much of the product in the containers will have been perishable. And these products will have no value whatsoever after a while.
Yeah.
We understand COVID vaccines were on board. They will have been destroyed. Further claims will ensue. The effect of the closure was to increase crude prices by up by 6% to $64 a barrel at the time. It also triggered a new surge in container spot rates, which are the highest since recording started in 2009.
And in simple English, for those of us who are not in the commodity trade and business and don't understand the jargon, what is a spot rate?
It's the rate that you pay today if you had to use one of the containers.
Thank you.
Shipping rates are a major component of our trade costs. So the new hike poses an additional challenge to the world economy as it struggles to recover from the pandemic. 80% of the goods that we consume are carried by ships. Most businesses will not be able to bear the brunt of the high rates and will certainly pass them on to the consumer if they can afford to pay them. Other claims will come from charterers. This is an interesting point. Other claims will come from charterers who were stuck and missed their delivery dates. There will be claims against them. There will be rejection of vessels, rejection of cargo. And further, on an HR point, the vessel has been held since the 5th of May. That's 37, sorry, vessels have been held since March, but that's we're now 37 days later. And of the 26 crew members on board at the time of the accident, 21 are still being denied the right to disembark.
I see.
And this is against all normal operating in HR rules.
I see. Okay.
And lastly, the whole supply chain has been dislocated over the last 12 months.
Can you imagine?
And now it has been aggravated by this accident. Before, businesses were suffering from supply chain failures due to the drop in demand resultant from COVID.
Yep.
Containers were in the wrong place at the wrong time. This left manufacturers scrambling to deal with shrinking inventory and delayed orders. I've experienced that myself in France. When I've gone to look for white goods, you can't find them. You just have to take what's given. In Germany, a shortage of products have forced manufacturers to cut production. Indeed, this dislocation and failure in the supply chain has forced companies to resort to air traffic, which is substantially more expensive, and rail freight, which is considerably slower. In short, the mind boggles at the lawsuits that will be filed around the world due to this awful event.
So not to be too short, but time is pressing today, Michael. It's been really a catastrophe of catastrophes, one on top of the other. Michael, let me turn to a bit more nearer to your own business, because you're essentially in the oil trading business. How would you categorize the modern debate on fossil fuels? I mean, I pose this question to you rather like a school examination question. Rationality versus emotion. Discuss. How would you answer that question, Michael? I know it's a big one, but give it a go.
Gosh, it's all very difficult. And indeed, there's a lot of emotion in all this.
Yes.
And little rationality. Fossil fuels have had a clear negative impact on global CO2 emissions. This is a reality. It's now important to harness the skills and the knowledge and the capital from these highly evolved embedded industries to help accelerate a transition to a more sustainable future. But the problem is, fossil fuels remain relatively cheap, and because the cost of pollution isn't usually factored into these costs. There are many alternative fossil fuels with far lower carbon footprints, and this includes electricity generated by nuclear power plants. We need to continue to press ahead with all the pressures that governments and communities can bring on society and industry to change their habits. This is not easy, but the momentum is there, and with Biden in power today, this is a game changer.
Your voice sounds quite confident, Michael, when you say that. Is it? I mean, you've been around long enough to have a fairly good sense of skepticism, even not cynicism, but skepticism. Do you feel that will make a difference?
I do, actually. I think that we've moved away from the previous leadership in America, which was denying any of the problems that we're facing today. And I do think that Biden is completely committed to ensuring that he can bring along with him all the other countries in this world so that we can combat the problems that we have today and to redress the damage that's been created over so many years. At MOCO, for example, that's my company, we're transitioning into low and lower carbon feedstocks and renewable technologies, and we look forward to helping accelerate this transition. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later. But what's interesting about African countries is that they skip the large fixed costs associated with landline telephones and went straight to mobile telephone networks. In the same way, there's a huge opportunity for African nations to leapfrog the developed nations by investing in decentralized renewable power networks. At MOCO, we're using our network with large domestic and international players in Africa to deliver renewable power solutions to industrial players in the region. In a recent global energy review, the International Energy Agency described a significant drop in energy for fossil fuels as a result of COVID pandemic. So we know we can live with less fossil fuels. Yeah. It is a possibility. However, it can be anticipated that demand is likely to rise again. But the good news is that the use of renewable electricity continues to grow and is now 25% of the global electricity consumption. That's just all
say,
good news.
Just say those numbers again, Michael, just in case listeners didn't get them, because there's a lot in what you've just said. But just run it by me again, please.
Yes, it's anticipated that demand will grow after the pandemic. And the good news is that the use of renewable electricity continues to grow and is today 25% of the global electricity consumption. So in conclusion, an emotional knee-jerk reaction to the current climate crisis will only hasten our demise. Let's be sensible and work through this problem collectively.
Of course, as you know, there's a very large dose of skepticism on the side of people who use, and I'm reluctant to use the word emotion too often, but if you listen sometimes to the speeches and tone of voice of great iconic figures like Sir David Attenborough, there's a lot of experience, but also a fairly hefty dose of emotion when speaking to the TV cameras and to audiences, particularly young audiences. So it's not an easy balance to strike.
It's obviously very difficult, but we need sustained leadership. And that's why I think that with Biden coming in, it's a game changer. And a lot of leaders have fallen in behind him, including Macron and the leadership in the UK as well.
Okay, I've got a Swiss question for you now, Michael. But before I do that, let me remind our listeners that my guest today is Michael Hacking, founder, president of MOCO, an oil trading company in Geneva. I'd like to turn to the merchant marine or merchant shipping, Michael. I often read that it is a distant, silent, and large polluter, larger than air transport. And when I first came to live in Switzerland, I heard the expression the Swiss Navy, and I thought it was a joke, rather like when I was a kid and older men used to tease me about hen's teeth and pigeon's milk. But I've since learned that Switzerland has one of the largest maritime merchant fleets in the world, 11th in size globally, close behind the UK, if my numbers are correct. Now tell me more about what is going on in this important sector, which is not always front of mind for most of us, and what role can Switzerland play, if any, to improve matters, regarding pollution?
Michael, I'd like to deal first with the shipping as a distant and silent large polluter, as you say, and to give you some facts around this. Maritime shipping is the world's most carbon-efficient form of transporting goods, actually far more efficient than road and air transport. Today's containers and vehicle carriers carry substantial quantities of goods across the world, and this has fueled global economy to a level that was inconceivable 50 to 60 years ago. Shipping is the backbone of our economy, allowing the world to trade more goods over greater distances.
Yeah.
Between 2000 and 2018, global GDP increased by approximately 65%, whilst international shipping increased by 93%, substantially more.
And that's because the prices have come down a lot.
Because prices have come down a lot and because of globalization, of course. Continued efforts are being made to reduce the carbon dioxide further through the following initiatives. Significant improvements to fuel quality with a subsequent reduction in emissions. New and larger, more efficient vessels with attention to naval architecture for reduced drag. Slow steaming is encouraged to achieve optimum fuel consumption per mile.
And what is slow steaming, for those of us who don't know that expression?
Yes, that's a good question. It's economical steaming rate. In other words, rather than going at full speed, you're finding the economical rate, that the engines work at the most efficient rate using the least amount of fuel for the distance that you're traveling.
Thanks, Michael.
And then mechanical modifications to existing ships are also being done. New ship builds since 2013 are approximately 30 to 40% more carbon efficient than those that they are replacing.
And you're, the shipping. Sorry, go on, Michael. Finish your point.
The shipping industry is committed to seeking further improvements in the fuel efficiency and reduced carbon footprint. And in fact, one such idea is to have driverless tankers, would you believe, with no accommodation on board so that you can get more cargo on board, and with a small bridge at the front of the vessel for the occasions when a pilot is required to dock the vessel.
Sounds frightening, Michael.
The mind boggles at the alternatives for tomorrow.
But you're saying to me then, Michael, you've busted the myth, because I've heard it from so many different sources that the merchant shipping is a greater pollutant than air transport, freight and passenger. And you're saying to me that that's not necessarily the case.
Not per mile, it's not. It's actually the most efficient. It's just that so much of, as I said to begin with, so much of the goods that we use are transported by ships. So because so much is going by shipping, it is a pollutant, in fact, in the world. And I've got the number, but I don't record it right these 5 seconds. Okay. And it's nearly the same as planes. But we're not to transporting so many goods by planes. It's much more.
No, I understand what you mean.
But it doesn't mean that we can rest on our laurels and not look at it. Indeed, there are lots of, as I said, there's a lot of pressure on the shipping industry to improve the carbon footprint they're creating.
Michael, let's turn now to your own company, because people in the industry will certainly know the name Moco, because they're a specialist in a specialist field. But I'm pretty sure that many people, ordinary people like me who are listening, won't know. How does a company, because I understand it's a relatively small company, how does a company like yours survive in a field populated by behemoths, and there are quite a few of them in Switzerland? And what motivated you to start the business in the first place? How have you survived, Michael?
Interesting. I was actually just going to deal with your comment about the Swiss Navy, but we'll pass over that and maybe come back to it later on. I believe that the difference, in response to your question here, I believe that the difference is that the behemoths that you have referred to all have one common denominator and weakness. They are simply driven by profit, by whatever means is open to them. A recent book called The World for Sale, written by Javier Blas and Jack Farshi. A couple of expert journalists have gone into detail on how these companies, many of them based in Switzerland, have grown and made their money over the years. The book is very explicit, detailed, well-researched, and I can highly recommend it.
What's the title again?
The World for Sale, by Javier Blas.
That's quite a contentious title. Good. Okay.
It's very much up to date. The company that I formed in 1998 started with minimal capital, with a strong belief that we could do business differently. It was all about money. It was not all about money, but more about trust, developing long-term relationships, and adding value to the delivery and logistics process. At an early stage, we understood the value of reputation. We did not go after all businesses that were presented. We did not seek to cut corners. We did not use old ships that were cheaper. We had a policy that worked, and we followed it. We focused on doing business with those we trusted, and we built long-term relationships.
But those laudable aims must have had a cost, Michael. I mean, or else a lot of other people will be doing the same thing, surely.
Well, I think a lot of people are trying to do the same thing. But if your major driver is simply to make profits by whatever means is open to you, then I think that that's where the difference comes, as far as we're concerned. And you know, at an early stage, we gave back to the communities where we operated. We bought a property in the year 2001, 2002, I think it was. We bought a property in Cape Town to house orphan children whose parents had died from HIV. We still have this home, and lots of kids have benefited from the house, managed today by Home from Home. And there's but we're different from other organizations. And a recent article by James Brading, that you know as well, Michael, I know, the author of Swiss Made, The Untold Story Behind Swiss Success.
He's been on the show a couple of times.
Has just written an article called Houston, We're in Trouble.
Yes, I have it here on my desk.
Yeah. Well, as you know, this article is about how a bank in Switzerland has lost its way and has for many years focused simply on making money and not on building trust or long-term relationships. The outcome was thus, that huge bonuses were paid for those that made money and little consideration was given to manage the banks, the bank for the welfare of their shareholders, the community, and the country.
And of course, they're not the only ones.
They're not the only ones.
No, Michael, look, I'm watching my clock here. We've got just a few minutes left, and you've touched already on Africa, and I wanted to come on to that before we close. It's been an omission of mine over the years on this show that we don't talk about Africa enough. Now, let me try to redress that balance now. You're close to Africa. You just mentioned a project in Cape Town. You do a lot of business on the continent. Just tell me briefly what type of business. How do you see the progress of that continent over the coming decades, let's say the next generation of about 25 years, what's realistic rather than aspirational in terms of economic development and the well-being of the people of sub-Saharan Africa? That's 46 out of the 54 countries, and I'm acutely aware that there are many differences among those 46, but give me a sense in the closing minutes of our conversation of how you see the future of Africa.
Thank you for the question, Michael. It certainly has been the mission of yours to have neglected Africa all this time, because it's an amazing continent with wonderful people and fantastic opportunities.
I've been there many times, but just the program hasn't.
Africa is very dear to my heart, and the continent has always been a huge fascination and a driver for me. I've had the good fortune to have spent quite some time in South Africa and in Kenya in my early days with my university degree from Cape Town, and then moving back to Switzerland to complete my MBA at IMD in Lausanne. Most of my business life has been in and around Africa. At Cargill, we exported maize from Zimbabwe to the Far East, understanding and managing the logistics through Southern Africa. Soon after, I entered the fuel business, and this kept me focused on Africa. In Africa, there's a lot of crude, but they lack the finished product. That is jet fuel, gas oil, and gasoline. They don't have the refining capacity to produce what the consumers need.
Yeah.
Since forming Mocha, our focus has been fully on the African continent, developing key relationships throughout the continent, spending much of the time understanding the complexities and surrounding the logistics of the supply chain. I can understand how that many people feel that Africa is simply riddled with corruption. I met a journalist once who said about Africa that it should be folded over and zipped up. How wrong she was, and I told her so at the time. We're no longer speaking. Briefly, let me go over some of the facts and challenges.
Please.
The first generation African leaders were guided and influenced by outgoing colonial leaders who sought preferential long-term trades benefiting the colonial powers. Little was done at arm's length, or in the interest of the countries that they were leaving behind. There are very poor educational facilities in Africa, and this needs to be redressed. And indeed, at Mocha, we're doing lots in this field. Mocha is sharing 20% of our profits this year, 2020, for education and the delivery of improved learning systems in Nigeria, Madagascar, and Zimbabwe.
Yeah.
Very little money has been spent on infrastructure in Africa. Train services are extremely poor to non-existent. Buses are old and unsafe. Roads are full of potholes. Electricity is unreliable or non-existent, creating huge outages. It's difficult to build on a legacy of poor infrastructure. But the continent is rich in natural resources, Michael.
Yes, I understand.
And has a huge tourist destination as well. Just in South Africa, 10 million international tourists came to South Africa in 2018. That's 2.8% of direct contribution to South Africa's GDP. 5% of the world's top oil-producing countries are in Africa. That's 9.6% of the world's crude output comes from Africa. However, exploration and production by major oil companies has done little to enrich the host country.
Yeah.
Africa ranks in quantity of reserves for copper, bauxite, cobalt, diamonds, phosphate, rock, and PGM, that's platinum group metals. All these metals are tomorrow, is what the world is looking for tomorrow. The Chinese have understood this and have invested at the source. And again, none of these precious resources have in any way benefited the host country.
But Michael, as we come to a close, are you confident that external investors like the Chinese will behave any better than the British, the Belgians, the French, and all the others who were there beforehand in the 19th and 20th century?
No, I don't think that they. I don't think that they will. And in conclusion, perhaps my comments are very much that Africa has not benefited from globalization. It's not a friend to Africa. Businesses and governments in the developed world have acted in self-interest with little thought to the needs of Africa, and most of Africa's trade is done internationally. Only 16% of Africa's business is done within Africa.
It's a tiny percentage.
Whilst in Europe, 75% of business which is traded within the European community.
But as I'm looking at you on the screen, I can tell by the smile on your face, Michael, that you're optimistic about the future there.
Well, I am, because I think that there's a good news which is coming through of educated Africans who are seemingly wanting to see themselves develop the continent and to stop being ripped off by larger trading powers and maybe the larger countries in the world. And so they've created a new African continental free trade area. This is an agreement that's brought together 54 of the African countries, where they've signed a protocol agreement to drop trade barriers between member states and to facilitate trade between them. This is very exciting. This is going to be one of the largest free trade agreements in the world.
Michael, it sounds like a topic for another interview separately on that. It's been an education listening to you. We could talk much longer, but we're out of time. So thanks very much for being my guest. My guest today has been Michael Hacking, founder, president of MOCO, a global supplier of oil based in Geneva. Thank you again, Michael.
It's been an absolute pleasure. There's a lot more I could tell you, Michael, and I'd love to carry on, but I know the time runs out and people are probably very bored. Take care.
Thank you.
The best, and have a great time. Bye.
That was the McKay Interview with Michael McKay. And don't forget, you can hear that interview again on our website, worldradio.ch.